Over the course of a momentous year, we've followed a lot of stories that never quite got resolved. So in an effort to tie up 2003 in a nice neat bow, fat chance, we're going to spend our last hour of the year catching up on a few items that slip between the cracks. Over the course of the program, a series of guests will join us, including Amy Smithson, who will bring us up to date on the search for Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, Jeffrey Rosen on legal issues in the courts, Joe Palca on science, and as always, we need your help. Is there a news story from the past year that never did quite arrive at a conclusion? What are the unanswered questions from 2003? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And we're going to begin with Mike Allen, who covers the White House for the Washington Post. He's with us on the phone from Crawford, Texas. And thanks for taking the time on New Year's Eve.
Happy New Year's, Neil. I'm at the coffee station in Crawford, Texas, where people were hoping the president would come by for a burger, but he's still out at the ranch.
Well, yesterday, we were surprised when one of our follow-up stories turned into front-page news. We were going to ask what progress had been made into the investigation of a White House leak. Yesterday, Attorney General John Ashcroft recused himself from that investigation. But before we go any further, Mike, remind us what happened.
Neil, yesterday, this was supposed to be a slow week, but yesterday the Justice Department announced that the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, was going to recuse himself from this investigation into who leaked the name of a CIA operative, and the Justice Department put the U.S. Attorney in Chicago in charge of the investigation, and we were told that he's going to make all the decisions about indictments, witnesses, all that. So it's all been... moved all the authority, the Justice Department announced yesterday, has been moved out of the main justice.
Now, this goes back to a story that involved the former ambassador, Joseph Wilson, who was dispatched on a mission to Africa to check into the story about uranium being supplied from Niger to Iraq. He reported back that there didn't seem to be a lot to it after the contention was still in President Bush's State of the Union address. A lot came out of it. The White House was accused of leaking the fact that his wife is a CIA agent.
Exactly. And the reason that some administration officials are thought to have done this is they didn't like what his report said, and so leaking this information was a way to discredit him, sort of like the way that someone became president of the company is because, you know, their dad, you know, was the owner. They're saying he got this mission to Niger not because he was qualified for it, but because his wife worked at the agency.
And the news value in terms of the investigation is that White House leaks are a daily event and hardly news except in terms of what they say. In this case, it's against the law to reveal the name of a CIA agent.
Right. Now, that's what's very interesting about this is this just gossip or was this a felony? Now, you look at the elements of the law, and in order for someone to be guilty of a crime, they would have had to know that she was undercover and have intentionally revealed it. Now, the White House, in denying their involvement, has done it on very narrow grounds. Your listeners have heard over and over the White House Press Secretary, Scott McClellan, say that White House officials didn't leak classified information. They've not denied that they discussed it with reporters. They've not denied that they called it to reporters' attention. But people at the White House feel fairly confident that this is tough enough to prove that no one there is guilty of a crime.
Well, let's move on to another issue. There were a lot of people who were sort of surprised to learn that that investigation was continuing with the vigor in which it apparently is, but we'll have to now await to see what the new prosecutor does with that, and that may take some time. But in another bit of fallout from the war in Iraq, there have been a lot of discussion about rivalries in the Bush administration between the State Department and the Department of Defense, the Department of Defense and the CIA. In October, it was suddenly announced that all Iraqi policymaking would be headquartered at the National Security Council, run by Condoleezza Rice. Has this move put a damper on any of these rivalries, and what has the Iraq Stabilization Group actually done thus far?
Well, what Dr. Rice said is that the function of the National Security Council is to coordinate, and this group will do just that. But what it was seen as was an undercutting of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. You might expect that the State Department would be in charge of rebuilding a country, but instead that's been the province of the Department of Defense. The civilian administrator there, Paul Bremer, reports to Secretary Rumsfeld. So this new stabilization group was seen as sort of a bureaucratic ploy to centralize things in the White House. Now, you can look at it from the other way, and you can say the White House realized that Iraq is how this president is going to be judged. And so they wanted to have as close day-to-day contact as they could. So you could say, you could look at it the other way and say this was stepping up to take responsibility for it. But the truth is that however it's parsed out on paper, the president realizes that this is going to be a huge issue in the campaign, and he's responsible no matter who's making the day-to-day calls about it.
And finally, Mike, before we let you go, the last time the press corps was down in Crawford en masse on a holiday, it was Thanksgiving, and of course the president snuck out the back door and went on a trip to Iraq. Is reporters keeping a closer eye on him this time around?
Yes, sir, indeed. We're watching each other very closely. Everybody wonders if it's going to be Kabul this time. But people are watching. You figure if you know where Spahn and Bonnie are, you know where the president is.
Mike Allen, thanks very much, and have a happy New Year's Eve there in Crawford, Texas.
Neil, happy holiday.
Mike Allen covers the White House for The Washington Post. In the months leading up to the United States declaration of war against Iraq, the case for preemptive military action revolved around Iraq's alleged possession of weapons of mass destruction. Last February, Secretary of State Colin Powell testified before the United Nations Security Council to make the Bush administration's best case that Iraq was in violation of United Nations of Security Council Resolution 1441.
The material I will present to you comes from a variety of sources. Some are U.S. sources and some are those of other countries. Some of the sources are technical, such as intercepted telephone conversations and photos taken by satellites. Other sources are people who have risked their lives to let the world know what Saddam Hussein is really up to. I cannot tell you everything that we know, but what I can share with you, when combined with what all of us have learned over the years, is deeply troubling.
Secretary Powell presented computer drawings of alleged mobile biolabs. He showed satellite photos of what he described as cleared-out weapon sites, and he played audio intercepts of Iraqi officers speaking to each other about evacuating weapons materials. Since Secretary Powell testified, the United States has, of course, invaded Iraq. It now occupies that country. That's given weapons inspectors considerable opportunity to follow up on the evidence used in making the case for war. Amy Smithson is an expert on chemical and biological weapons. She was our guest on the day of Powell's testimony. She joins us again today. She's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and it's good to have you back.
Pleasure to be with you.
So let's look again at some of the evidence. It was estimated last February by Secretary Powell that Iraq held between 100 and 500 tons of chemical agents. Has the U.S. made any progress towards verifying that?
As of yet, the soldiers and officials who are looking for weaponized agent, either chemical or biological, have not encountered munitions, certainly not on that scale, according to David Kay, who's leading this effort.
So the suggestion that Iraq had weapons in the field ready to use, no evidence of that?
No evidence yet, and I think that's probably the correct way to continue to portray this, because Iraq is a very large country, and the Iraqis had a habit of not marking chemical munitions and storing them at conventional weapons sites. So there may still be things that are uncovered. This is not the first day of the search by any stretch of the imagination, but it certainly isn't the last.
As we mentioned before, Secretary Powell presented computer drawings of mobile bio labs. Later, forces found vans that looked a little bit like those drawings. What did they turn out to be?
Indeed, they did find a few trailers that looked to be mobile weapons laboratories. And in fact, in May, the CIA released a report asserting that the legitimate uses for these facilities were unlikely. But it's possible that these facilities could have been used either to make biological agents, or perhaps they were used to make hydrogen or missile propellants. They're still trying to sort this one out, and apparently they're making some headway because they have the scientists who are involved in this aspect of the program in hand.
We also saw before and after satellite photographs of chemical munitions bunkers, what Secretary Powell said were chemical munitions bunkers, that had been disassembled. Has investigation put any new light on that?
I'm afraid they're still looking for the needles in the proverbial haystack there. Again, lots of empty munitions, some 30,000 empty munitions that United Nations inspectors were never able to account for. A lot of precursors, some 500 tons of precursor chemicals that could have been used to make additional agent and fill those munitions. Where the end of this trail lies, I think we're still going to have to be patient.
Now, alleged concealment efforts included several intercepted communications. We heard a clip just a moment ago, a conversation between a colonel and a captain in which they talked about removing references to nerve agents from wireless instructions. Anything more we've learned about that?
According to David Kay, there certainly has been a systematic destruction and cleaning out of records and files and hard drives on computers. This is not the type of thing that happens sporadically. They found it almost everywhere they went. And that's one of the things that will make it tremendously difficult to put together the pieces of this puzzle, particularly if the scientists that are in coalition hands are not cooperating.
Let's get a caller on the line, and James is with us from Wimberley, Texas.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is about the pictures that Secretary Powell showed of those bunkers, or that bunker that was supposedly taken at two different times, showing vehicle traffic and so forth. A close examination of the photographs, I think, will show that those were two different bunkers, similar but different. They had to be different because the pattern of roadways around the bunkers is not the same, and yet they were portrayed as before and after pictures of the same bunker.
Any evidence of that, Amy?
Well, I'm not a photographic analyst, and so I'm afraid it would be inappropriate for me to comment on that. I think that in the days ahead, there will be a lot of explanation, hopefully from intelligence officials, about how they came to their conclusions, and pointed discussion of the differences that professionals in the field, as well as those interested listeners that you have,
mm-hmm.
about how this evidence may not match up to the case that they made, or at least the strength of the case that they asserted.
James, I'm afraid you may have to call back on this day next year and ask the same question.
Okay, one follow-up, though. It shouldn't take an expert to tell if there are a different number or pattern of roadways coming into the bunker, even if the viewpoint of the photograph changes. So take a look at the photographs is all.
Okay, James. Thanks very much for the call.
Uh-huh.
As you mentioned, Amy Smithson, there are Iraqi scientists who are being held. We may have to resume this after the break, but briefly, you were talking back in February about evidence of chemical and biological experimentation on Iraqi prisoners. Has the scientists been forthcoming about that?
Well, this was actually an assertion that Secretary Powell made in his speech. I mentioned that some 1,600 prisoners on death row may have been used in human experiments with chemical and biological weapons. Apparently, there is some headway being made on whether or not this actually occurred, but I'm not sure that these scientists are cooperating as extensively as they could because there simply aren't incentives for them to do so.
Because if they're found out, they could face war crimes trials.
That's true. Not only have they been isolated from their families, apparently they have not been given immunity from prosecution for war crimes. And so it's difficult for them to say, what's in it for me if I cough up the goods? Recently, there has been an amount of money set aside, $2 million, in order to provide these scientists with research grants so that they can work on peaceful projects. And that would hopefully preclude the scientists that may have worked in these programs from sharing their expertise or materials with terrorists or with other countries trying to proliferate these weapons.
We'll continue with Amy Smithson and Weapons of Mass Destruction after the break, and we'll also move on to some of the legal stories that captured our attention in 2003. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're catching up on some of the stories of 2003 that has still have unanswered questions. In a few minutes, we're going to go with Jeffrey Rosen and talk about some of the legal issues that came up in the past year, gay marriage, other things. Give us a call if you'd like to ask about one of those, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us at totn@npr.org. Still with us is Amy Smithson, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We're talking about the evidence that Secretary of State Colin Powell presented at the United Nations Security Council about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. And Amy, as you look at the case overall, have Powell's claims been borne out in the developments of the last 11 months?
The claims of weaponized agents, the assertions by administration officials that there was an imminent threat that munitions would be fired, as of yet have not been borne out. Whether in the months ahead additional information or materials, munitions comes to light, again, I don't know. I wish I had that crystal ball. What it does appear to be more on the concrete side is the assertion that they were trying to preserve the capabilities to make these weapons. Not only have they found additional laboratory complexes and research in the biological area, they're finding other things to corroborate the preservation of these capabilities.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Chuck in San Francisco.
Hi.
Hi.
I was impressed when I was watching the Powell testimony before the UN that it didn't seem like the evidence he was presenting, it seemed like if that's the bar we're setting for mounting major military operations, that bar is pretty low. It looked like the facilities were fairly small scale, and that if we're going to devote the same amount of effort that we've devoted to dealing with Iraq, we might be finding similar facilities if we looked hard enough all over the place.
Amy Smithson, not only Chuck's point, but if the United States intelligence services are going to make similar claims about other countries, they're also going to have some credibility problems after what happened in Iraq.
They will definitely have some credibility problems. And as far as the difficulty of sorting the wheat from the chaff here, particularly in the chemical and biological weapons areas, it's going to remain an onerous task. Facilities that can be used to make commercial products that are part of everyday modern life, everything from pesticides to medicine, can be used to mask weapons programs. This is something that Iraq did quite well, and it's also something that the former Soviet Union did on a huge scale. So telling the difference between a legitimate facility and one that is involved in covert weapons activities is going to remain a challenge henceforth. As for the credibility issue, the United States, its foreign and security policies for years, if not decades ahead, may have to live with the legacy of what not just U.S. citizens, but those around the world perceive as the gap between what the United States asserted and what has yet to be found in Iraq in terms of weapons of mass destruction.
Chuck, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks.
And Amy Smithson, we wanted to thank you for your time on New Year's Eve, and we wish you a very happy new year.
To you and your listeners as well.
Thank you very much. Amy Smithson, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She was with us today from her office in Washington, D.C. Before we leave the question of what has been found and what hasn't in Iraq, Secretary Powell also spoke not only about weapons of mass destruction, but about what he said was the brutalization of the Iraqi people by Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athist regime. That is a claim on which a great deal more evidence has come to light. The bodies of tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people buried in mass graves in Iraq. If you think about it, if you count in the Iran-Iraq war, the invasion of Kuwait, and the brutalization of his own people, Saddam Hussein may be responsible for the deaths of more Muslims in the 20th century than any other individual. This year saw a number of notable stories on the legal front, and joining us now to chase some of those loose ends is Jeffrey Rosen. He's an associate professor at George Washington Law School, legal affairs editor at The New Republic, and he's with us from his home here in Washington, D.C. Good to have you on the line again, Jeffrey.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Arguably, two of the most anticipated decisions were Supreme Court rulings on affirmative action. Refresh our memories.
Affirmative action, of course, was the most hotly awaited Supreme Court decision perhaps since abortion. There was some fear about what would happen if the court continued on the path that it had been taking and imposed meaningful limitations on universities' ability to engage in racial preferences. As it happened, though, in a carefully wrought opinion by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, the court ended up ratifying the status quo. It essentially gave universities pretty broad discretion to use affirmative action, as they'd been doing in the past, although it said that they couldn't be completely obvious about it, that naked preferences based on numerical targets were impermissible, but less transparent preferences would be allowed. And universities breathed a great sigh of relief, at least those that supported the programs they'd been administering. And I gather that, by and large, things haven't changed too much, that most universities have been able to continue with the programs they'd had in place. The University of Michigan undergraduate program, which was at odds in that case, has been slightly altered to take account of the court's demand for the lack of explicit preferences. But since Justice O'Connor said that universities have about 25 years more to try to raise performance standards and to eliminate the need for preferences, there's a feeling that basically universities are home clear.
A lesser court was the source of another notable decision. That's the Massachusetts Supreme Court. It weighed in on gay marriage, and it turned, as I remember, the onus of moving ahead on this over to the Massachusetts state legislatures. Has anything happened there?
The legislature is debating right now precisely what to do. The governor has made clear that he supports a bill that would allow civil unions but not gay marriage. And if that bill passes the legislature, there's a question about whether or not the Massachusetts court will accept it. And depending on whether or not it does accept it, then an awful lot of complicated legal consequences could follow from that.
Earlier, President Bush was, when he's asked about the prospect of a United States constitutional amendment on gay marriage, has said he didn't think it was necessary. He shifted slightly.
He did indeed. He's under great pressure from social conservatives to endorse a gay marriage amendment. When it looked like the Massachusetts court would indeed require gay marriage and that Massachusetts marriages might be recognized in other states, Bush felt more pressure to embrace an amendment. But the feeling now is that there's so many legal hoops to jump through before marriage is a real possibility that he can enjoy the political benefits of watching the Democrats squirm as they endorse marriage and run the risk of alienating the moderate majority and pleasing their base. But he doesn't actually have to put his money where his mouth is, because there's going to be no immediate need for an amendment for the foreseeable future.
Let's get a caller in. This is Marco, who joins us from San Francisco.
Yes, hi, Neil.
Hi. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. My biggest sort of legal story that I was concerned about is about the lawlessness of the Guantanamo Bay prisoners and this ability of the U.S. to sort of circumvent even the Geneva Convention in holding them there.
It's a very important story, and we've just heard the Ninth Circuit Court in California had an important ruling on it about a week ago, where it said that the U.S. actually was obliged to be sued on Guantanamo because Guantanamo was part of U.S. territory. This created a conflict with the appellate court in Washington, D.C., which had held a few months ago that Guantanamo was not a U.S. jurisdiction and therefore that no writs of habeas corpus would lie. And the Supreme Court has agreed to decide this important case in the spring and will have a definitive ruling. Now, we don't know whether the court will just make a narrow decision about whether or not Guantanamo is or isn't U.S. territory, or whether it will embrace the broader question about whether or not prisoners out of the U.S. Are susceptible to the enforcement of U.S. constitutional rights. That would require overturning an important decision from the World War II era, and the court has lots of options as it decides whether or not to enforce the Guantanamo prisoners' rights.
Those prisoners in Guantanamo Bay were picked up in Afghanistan. They are from many different countries, including some from important American allies, including Britain and Australia. The United States offered to let one of the Australian prisoners see a lawyer. Has that gone ahead as far as you know, Jeffrey?
I don't know whether or not he's seen a lawyer yet, but I do know that the U.S. has made clear its decision in the immediate future to actually try some of the Guantanamo people before military tribunals. And just the other day, someone was appointed to supervise the appointment of judges to military tribunals and make decisions about lawyers. So this, of course, is the next great shift of the debate. We haven't yet had any tribunal trials, but once they're up and running, there'll be all sorts of questions about whether or not they're congressionally authorized, whether what sort of lawyers and rights that people have under them, and most important of all, will citizens be tried under them? Until now, the president has said they'll only try aliens, but there's some rumbling about the possibility of trying citizens as well, like the two enemy combatants who are being held, Yasser Hamdi and Jose Padilla. And this will mark a shift of the legal battle from the question of detention and interrogation to the question of actually trying people under military tribunals, and there'll be lots of legal challenges arising out of that.
Marco, I think you've pointed to one of the big stories of 2004. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, and Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you. Now, separation between church and state made the news this year, most dramatically in the form of Roy Moore, Alabama's former Chief Justice. He was convicted on ethics charges stemming from his defiance of a federal court order that required him to remove a Ten Commandments monument from the Alabama Judicial Building. In November, he lost his job. The state's Court of the Judiciary voted unanimously to remove Moore from office, which begs the question, what about the monument? Where did it go? Joining us once again from his office in Birmingham, Alabama, is Sean Ryan, Metro Desk Editor at the Birmingham Post-Herald. And good to talk to you, and Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year to you.
So, Sean, where's the monument?
Basically, it's in a broom closet in the Judicial Building. That's something of a misnomer. It is in a storage room. It's too big for a broom closet, but it's in a storage room out of sight of everybody.
And it belongs to Judge Moore, as I understand.
Yes, technically it belongs to him. I guess if you wanted to go the follow the money, it belongs to his supporters who actually paid for the monument, and so that Judge Moore would put it in the Judicial Building and have a controversy arisen over it. But it's got a little copyright on the back side of it. It says, copyright Judge Roy Moore.
He copyrighted the Ten Commandments?
Well, not the Ten Commandments. It's got Ten Commandments. It's got some other historical sayings on it, too. It's the design that's copyrighted, not the actual words that are on it.
Then what about the judge himself, Roy Moore? Have we heard the last from him?
Oh, I don't think so. He's laying low right now. People in Alabama are kind of tired of him. He was so in the news all year long. Right now, he's kind of playing it cool. We're wondering whether he's going to run against Senator Shelby when he comes up for re-election next year, or possibly in 3 years, whether he may go for the governorship of Alabama. That seems to be the general feeling, is that he may try to be governor.
But he's also appealing his removal, and as I understand, all the other judges on the court have recused themselves.
Yes, all nine Supreme Court justices recused themselves from the case, so under Alabama law, what you do is you take the names of all retired circuit and district court judges and Supreme Court judges, put them in a box, and draw names. And they drew nine more names. Roy Moore's attorneys disagreed with two of them or appealed two of them, so they were pulled. Right now, there's a court of nine. They're expected to hear Moore's appeal sometime in January.
And as I understand, we're going to have some changes for you coming up in the new year.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I am moving. I'm going to be the features editor at the Anniston Star in Alabama, one of the papers, smaller papers here in the state, but Columbia Journalism Review calls it one of the top 30 papers in the country.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Sean Ryan, and a Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you.
Sean Ryan joined us from his office in Birmingham, Alabama today. This is his last day as the Metro Desk Editor at the Birmingham Post-Herald. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we're still with Jeffrey Rosen. We're talking about some of the court cases that made news this past year. And just looking ahead, Jeffrey, the Supreme Court, the set of decisions that we're going to be expecting in the spring could be another big year.
It could indeed. Of course, we've already had the campaign finance case, which was one of the most important and hotly awaited cases for an awfully long time. But we're still looking forward, as we've been discussing, to a ruling on the Guantanamo prisoners and also the fate of the two enemy combatants of Jose Padilla and Yasser Hamdi, although the court hasn't yet agreed to hear that cases. A certiorari petition is pending in the Hamdi case, and we've just had an important decision from the Second Circuit. So this will raise the great question, what role is the Supreme Court going to play on the role on terrorism? It's avoided a big ruling so far, but two lower courts just last week made clear that they've resisted the president's claim that there's no role for judicial review at all, and because this court has been quite assertive of its prerogatives and has balked at broad assertions of executive privilege during the Clinton years, this might be the time or the year when the Supreme Court really says that it, too, has a role to play here.
There was an alleged 20th hijacker in the 9/11 incident, Mr. Moussaoui, who has been on course for trial in Northern Virginia, but the government's case there has gone off track.
It has indeed. The judge insisted on his ability to confront certain witnesses. The government was reluctant to allow that, and it now faces a decision about whether or not to continue to try to bring a civilian trial or whether to try him instead in a military tribunal, which would be an embarrassment, would represent a dramatic change of course. And there will be all sorts of important strategic decisions there.
There was also the most important legislative change after 9/11 was the passage of the Patriot Act. A case coming up in Florida could be the first test of that.
It could, and this really raises the very great question, is it possible to focus the surveillance powers of the Patriot Act so that they only are available in cases involving suspected terrorists but can't be used for domestic surveillance? The Florida case raises some of that question of proportionality, as do several bills now pending in Congress, introduced by an interesting bipartisan coalition of civil libertarian liberals and libertarian conservatives that would repeal parts of the Patriot Act and really focus its provisions just on suspected terrorists. So we'll see both congressional and judicial efforts to more narrowly target the Patriot Act.
And Jeffrey Rosen, if you had to think back on the court case, and it doesn't have to be one of the big cases, but obviously you have major sports figures, major entertainment figures on trial around the country. It's been an extraordinary year in the courts.
It really has. The celebrity cases always occupy a lot of attention, although they tend not to teach us so much about enduring principles. But I suppose if I had to pick a single one all year, it might well be the great sodomy case, Lawrence in Texas, where you had that spectacle of Justice Anthony Kennedy, a Reagan appointee, embracing not only the rhetoric, but really some of the reasoning of Roe versus Wade that conservatives had been so suspicious of, and giving us a very broad and sweeping defense of constitutional protections for individual autonomy that thrilled liberals and inflamed conservatives who argued that this would resurrect the possibility of a new culture war. Whether or not they can manage to do that remains to be seen, but it certainly was high judicial drama and lots of fun to read.
Jeffrey Rosen, as always, a pleasure to talk to you, and Happy New Year.
Very Happy New Year. Thank you so much for having me.
Jeffrey Rosen is legal affairs editor at The New Republic, the author of The Naked Crowd, Reclaiming Security and Freedom in an Anxious Age. Here are some of the stories we're following here at NPR News today. A large explosion ripped through a restaurant in central Baghdad. Witnesses there say a car bomb was to blame and that dozens of people have been injured. In New York, tonight's New Year's celebration could be the most heavily guarded party ever. Workers sealed manhole covers and removed mailboxes to guard against possible bombs in Times Square. You can hear details on those stories coming up later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. When we come back from a break on Talk of the Nation, we're going to be turning to issues of science. What are your questions about the science stories of 2003 that you never heard about after they were reported? Joe Palca is going to be joining us, and he's going to be talking, I understand, about cars, SARS, and Mars. Stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, in our headlong flight toward a digital society, is information becoming ephemeral? That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. We'll take a look at the effort to turn ones and zeros into a durable internet archive, so join us at that time. There were a lot of memorable science headlines over the past year, and we can only focus on a few of them. NPR's Joe Palca is with us, and he's, I stole his line, he's the one who called it the Mars, SARS, and Cars segment. And so Ryman, Joe Palca, thanks very much for joining us, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, and it's nice to be here.
We'll start far away and work our way closer to home. Scientists still waiting to hear from Beagle 2, the British effort to put a lander on Mars. What's the latest?
The latest is, you're absolutely right, they're still waiting to hear something. You know, it was supposed to land, or it probably did land on the Red Planet on Christmas Day, very early, or depending on what time zone you're in. Anyway, and it was supposed to send a signal back, but so far, you know, it hasn't been detected by radio telescopes here on Earth. It hasn't been detected by the orbiters that are the U.S. orbiters that are currently orbiting around Mars. The latest is they're going to tell it to go into an emergency communications mode, and it'll try to reach the Mars Express orbiter, which is the European Space Agency spacecraft that actually released it at the end and sent it to Mars, and that might be in a better configuration to pick up its signal if it's sending a signal. I mean, that's the hopeful outcome, is that some reason it's not communicating with the U.S. satellites.
This is just one of a series of ill-starred efforts to put a lander on Mars.
Well, yeah, it's turned out to be, I mean, it's, well, think about it, Neil. I mean, you're talking about another planet. It's harsh conditions. You have to hit it dead on with your rocket when you leave off from Earth, and landing is tough. We've been arguing all day about whether they're successes or not.
And you have to remember that feet and meters are different.
Right, but there's those things. I mean, there was a Russian lander called Mars 3, or Soviet lander, I guess, as it was at the time, that landed on Mars and transmitted for 20 seconds and then stopped. So we've decided that that's a propaganda success and a scientific failure. The successes have been the two Viking landers and the Pathfinder, which was in 96. But there have been 11 tries and only three clear-cut successes.
There's been speculation in and around Washington that President Bush may soon announce a renewed effort to go back to the moon. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I know that it was, you know, in Washington, these things seem to be what's known as trial balloons. I guess they're in science, too. Maybe science has a better name for them. But it's been kicked around. Before we leave Mars, I just want to mention, though, Neil, that there's two U.S. landers mm-hmm. that are on their way, and they could very well land successfully. The first one's supposed to be touching down on Saturday night. And so we may have a success again, not too long. But the whole idea is that, you know, the space program, the U.S. space program, has been a little bit without a focus. The space station is never captured the public imagination the way the moon mission, for example, did. And I think everybody's casting about for some new direction. The thought that it would be exciting to go to Mars is tempered by the thought that it would be astronomically expensive to go to Mars. And so some people said, well, maybe we should just, you know, get our sea legs back, our mm-hmm. space legs back by going to the moon and see if that works. But, you know, everybody looks at the budget and says, okay, we want to do this very, very expensive project, and everybody thinks it would be fun, and we'd probably get a lot of enthusiasm, but it's hard to know where the money would come from.
Let's get a caller involved. Jeff's on the line with us from Oswego, New York.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Actually from Owego, O-W-E-G-O, another fine Indian name here in central New York.
I actually saw the spelling without the S, and I thought it somebody just skipped the S, and I apologize.
There's a lot of names that sound similar. My question is regarding global warming. Is there such a thing? We hear stories about it, different scientific data. Some reports say there is, there isn't. It's been eliminated from some of the government reports. Do we have to worry about it? I'm looking at a snowless central New York right now, but last winter we were bombarded with record snow.
Any conclusive evidence on global warming?
Well, this is let me say that the first thing you have to do is dissociate in your mind last year's weather or this year's weather or next week's weather from the question of global warming. One's a meteorological condition and the other's a global climate condition, and they're two different things. So people always, I mean, I remember one summer a few years ago, it was very hot in Washington and everybody assumed that this was global warming. It's not. It was the Bermuda High, which keeps hot water poised over Washington sometimes. There's a lot of snow in upstate New York. I'm sorry, that's not global warming. That's a lake effect. But your question is an apt one, because there is some question. But I have to say the scientific community seems very convinced that human activity is having an effect on the global climate, and it's probably having an effect that's causing warming. That seems to be the scientific consensus now. Politically, that's unpopular, but scientifically, it seems fairly a good consensus.
So, Jeff, maybe a cardboard snowman with your snowless central New York.
That'll be great. Thank you very much.
Happy New Year.
You too. Bye-bye.
Let's move on to a story here, another story here on Earth. SARS, at the beginning of this year, we were caught in the grip of a fear, a mystery disease. What do we know now that we didn't know then?
Well, we know the agent, the virus in this case, that causes the disease. We have some notion on a vaccine that might be available, although it's being developed, I suppose, to prevent the disease. We also know that you can control the disease by taking appropriate public health measures. We also know that the catastrophe that might have been was not. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you had SARS, it was a catastrophe, but only 8,000 or so people in the world had it. And there was about, oh gosh, I've not written the number down, but it was about 400 or 500 deaths. No, maybe it was more, 700 deaths that were recorded. But most of those were in China and Hong Kong, so the world community did a fairly good job of protecting themselves, although, of course, it was anxious for a while. And, of course, and the other things people are watching very closely. There is one more case that is being investigated in China right now. Is this just one isolated case, or is this the start of a new epidemic? I don't think people would care to speculate right at this moment.
And obviously, further speculation, is this something that's going to come back each year like flu? Well, a much more serious disease.
Right. Well, that's the issue. And, you know, from 1 year's example, it's hard to predict, you know, a 50-year outcome. A few years would be nice. But it is true that this completely went away. So it's not like HIV, which was, it didn't have a seasonal component. It just kept growing and growing and growing. In this case, like flu, SARS seems to have a seasonal component, and we were out of the SARS season for a while. And now, if scientists are right, we're back in the SARS season, if there is a SARS season.
Well, now let's take you back to a very snowy last January, as our caller from Owego pointed out, when President Bush made his State of the Union address.
In this century, the greatest environmental progress will come about not through endless lawsuits or command and control regulations, but through technology and innovation. Tonight, I'm proposing $1.2 billion in research funding so that America can lead the world in developing clean, hydrogen-powered automobiles.
How much closer is the hydrogen car coming to an auto dealership near you?
somewhat.
A couple of blocks, maybe?
Yeah, no. Well, let's put it this way. Don't sell your current car. It's going to be a while. And the other problem, Neil, is that if you get the solar, if you get the hydrogen powered car, if that comes sooner, you're going to have a hard time finding a fill-up station because, as I've ridden around in the country, I haven't seen too many places selling hydrogen for hydrogen-powered cars. I mean, they just don't exist yet. So we're talking about a major change. I mean, you know, gas stations are common now because they've been put in over the last 60, 70 years. To create that same sort of infrastructure could take a while. And, you know, developing these cars, sure, it's a fine idea, but they will probably be more expensive than conventional cars, and it's a question of whether the economics is ever going to work for this technology.
And finally, an email question from Phyllis. Whatever happened to the supposed cloned human baby? I know you talked with this with Bob Edwards on Morning Edition about this.
Well, I think the key word in that question is supposed. The answer is, if there was a baby at all, I don't know what happened to it, because the person who announced that this was Brigitte Boiselier of the Raelian sect, who believe that space aliens came to Earth and told us that cloning was our destiny, has never actually provided, you know, the kind of proof that would convince the man on the Clapham Omnibus, I think that's the expression, that such a baby even exists, let alone that it's a clone baby, or she's a clone baby, if you want to go that far. So what do you do? I can't answer that question because I have no certain information. I do know that other people are trying to produce a clone baby, and they have admitted that so far they haven't succeeded. Now, they may, but they haven't claimed that they've succeeded yet.
Thanks very much.
Welcome.
And Happy New Year, Joe.
Pleasure to be here, and I hope you have one as well, Neil.
Thank you. NPR science correspondent Joe Palca, who was with us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we end our show today with a story that's not of the magnitude of those we've discussed earlier, but one telling about the mood of the nation as it went through the war in Iraq. Freedom fries entered the lexicon this year. Joining us now for an update is NPR congressional reporter Andrea Seabrook. She joins us by phone from the basement of the Longworth office building here in Washington, D.C. And good of you to be with us today.
Hi, Neil.
Where are you exactly?
I'm actually, I've just been booted out of the Longworth cafeteria. I'm now standing outside its glass doors, sort of peering across the cafeteria, looking at, there's one franchise called Sunset Strips inside the cafeteria that sells chicken strips and fries.
And are those still Freedom Fries?
They are indeed still Freedom Fries. You can get your chicken strips and Freedom Fries here in the Capitol. In fact, there's a little framed plaque right at the side of the chicken strip stand. That's the original plaque that was put up earlier this year that says "Update: House Office Buildings Now Serving Freedom Fries."
Now, I understand you've spoken with some of the employees there in the cafeteria before they chucked you out. Do people really come up to them and say, I'll have a plate of Freedom Fries, or do they use the more familiar Gallic nomenclature?
Well, it sounds like, from what people told me, and these are the people who are sort of dishing out these fries every single day, they in fact themselves have a hard time sticking to Freedom Fries. And one of them said to me, you know, you call it one thing your whole life and then suddenly having to change it to something else. I mean, this is not an overnight change that happens in a person. So, and apparently the customers also, have, you know, a little trouble sticking to, the new nomenclature, though, especially since things sort of, you know, the whole outroar sort of died down after a while. But apparently it's the congressional pages, who are sort of the interns of Capitol Hill, that are really big on this and have a lot of fun correcting people in line as they wait for their chicken strips, and who make sure that everybody uses the right word here.
Any idea of how long this order is going to remain in effect?
Well, that's a good question. I spoke to actually the manager of this cafeteria. This is one of the main cafeterias in the Capitol complex. I spoke to the manager, and he said to me earlier today, you know, hey, you know, an act of Congress is an act of Congress. You know, it makes it the status quo. And if you, you know, you want it to go back to French fries, they're going to have to, you know, switch it back. And there's no movement that I've seen of doing that. And so this manager said to me, you know, Freedom Fries, it's what they are from now on.
Andrea Seabrook, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
NPR's Andrea Seabrook, she's a congressional reporter. She joined us from the basement of the Longworth office building where she was excluded from the cafeteria there, which is still serving Freedom Fries. This year, Talk of the Nation was produced by Susan Lund, Setsko Sato, Justine Kennan, Megan Williams, Alicia Montgomery, Cece Fadope, Susan Davis, Joel Riddle, Stacey Foxwell, Sarah Handel, Marcus Rosenbaum, and Evie Stone. Chad Campbell directs our program. Brendan Banizak is our production assistant. And Molly Messick is the reigning TOTN intern. Our technical director is Kevin Waite. He gets engineering help from Vince Muse, Neil Tivolt, Suzanne Herron, Cal Southworth, Linda Mack, Josh Rogerson, Kimberly Jones, Sherry Marshevsky, Michael Cullen, and Mitch Eaton. We get plenty of help throughout the year from Rob Robinson's library staff. Our thanks to program librarians Robert Goldstein, Catherine Baer, Giselle Foss, Denise Chen, Maurice Clements, and Dan Onstad. Reference librarians Key Molesky, Alphonse Vinn, Dorothy Hickson, Beth Howard, and new mom Holly Witt. NPR's operations desk is staffed by Dave Argentieri, Bill Craven, Jasmine Campbell, Jim Leffert, Thomas, and Tom Woodward. Alan Silva is our senior editor. Sue Goodwin is our senior producer. The executive producer of Talk of the Nation is Leith Bishop. If you're traveling today, please be careful and have a happy new year. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.